This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Later on, will Obama's stimulus plan provide jobs and breathe life into the economy?
But first, let's listen to Ajahn Poo of Domestic Workers United explain more about what's happening with that group within the workforce.
Every morning, 200,000, mostly immigrant women of color, get out of bed and they go to work. They work as nannies, housekeepers, and elderly caregivers throughout the five boroughs and all over the metropolitan area, Long Island, Westchester. They do the work that makes all other work possible in New York. If domestic workers went on strike one day, I can't think of a single sector in New York that wouldn't be touched or affected by it. It's part of the economy, and yet it's one of the most invisible workforces within our economy. Some of the working conditions that you will find in this workforce are the worst, almost unimaginable. Anything goes. There are no standards, no guidelines. Domestic workers are excluded from most labor laws. Some of the most significant victories of the New Deal all exclude domestic workers by name. There's been a historical legacy of repeated exclusion and discrimination against this workforce, a history where the work has been done by women of color and immigrant women who also, by virtue of their position in society, are discriminated against and marginalized in various ways. The workplace is scattered in 200,000 homes, and no one knows who they are, where they are, which is a workplace, which isn't. It's structurally wired for abuse and exploitation. Workers working for far below minimum wage, people not getting paid at all, fired with no notice, no severance pay, fired for getting pregnant, sexually harassed, raped, verbally abused. The unimaginable happens behind closed doors in New York. What we are doing as Domestic Workers United is organizing, where it was said it could not be done. Over the years, we have won over $400,000 in unpaid wages for domestic workers who are underpaid by their employers through doing everything from filing lawsuits to picketing in front of the investment banks where their employers work, to going to their apartment buildings on Park Avenue and picketing there, picketing wherever they go. Through these creative ways of really putting pressure on employers and sending a message that if you mistreat your worker, you will have consequences, we've started to change the climate in this sector. Even before the financial crisis, there was a crisis in this industry. The stories that would come to our door were stories that were horrific and unimaginable. And they were not individual incidences. It's a systemic situation in this sector where it's structurally wired for abuse. Now that the financial crisis has set in, we are looking at a crisis of really immense proportions. We were receiving an average of about 3 calls per week from workers who were severely abused or underpaid. Now we are looking at a situation where we're getting about 7 calls a day from workers. They're getting their wages cut, getting their hours cut, getting fired with no notice. In some cases, employers saying to them, you no longer have a job here. I found someone who will work for half as much as you, happening on a regular basis. And so then what we're finding is that workers, for fear of becoming unemployed and losing their work, are actually staying in highly exploitative and highly oppressive job situations. So the conditions are just getting more and more dangerous. So for the last 5 years, what we've been doing in Domestic Workers United is fighting for a Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. The Domestic Workers Bill of Rights is a piece of statewide legislation that will establish labor standards for domestic workers for the first time in the history of this country in any state. It will set the tone for how labor standards are defined for domestic workers. It includes notice of termination, severance pay, paid holidays, health care, an annual cost of living wage adjustment, protection from discrimination and unjust firing, a day of rest per week, basic rights that otherwise a domestic worker would have no hope of negotiating on her own. And so in the absence of being able to put these provisions into the law, they will never be a reality for the majority of the workforce. We've been fighting for this bill for the last 4 years, and we're at a critical juncture because we finally have a Democrat majority in the Senate, and it is finally a possibility that we can win this legislative session. But it's going to take all of us in order to make that a reality. The Bill of Rights offers an example for what's possible in this moment for all low-wage workers and for some of the most important sort of cornerstone labor forces for us here in New York City. At the same time that conditions for the working class are becoming more and more difficult, more and more frightening, there are going to be acts of resistance. And some of them are going to be highly organized and highly strategic, and some of them are going to be more spontaneous, like the Republic Windows and Doors workers, who occupied their factory to hold Bank of America accountable. This is an example of what is going to be happening more and more throughout our great city and throughout the country. So we've got to find a way to support and sustain these efforts and coalesce these scattered forms of resistance towards moving real transformative agendas for economic recovery. And we have an opportunity to do that. As much as the crisis is a crisis, it is also one of the greatest opportunities we have to actually move real, fundamental, transformative change. We have to organize and work together across sectors and communities. We really have no choice. But the possibilities of what we can win in this moment if we do choose to do that are much beyond anything that we could have imagined 5 years ago, 10 years ago. The framing of economic recovery allows us to put together what have historically been segregated or siloed issues that we've all been fighting around. We can finally put together economic justice, environmental justice and sustainability with affordable housing creation and workers' rights in one set of demands under one framework for economic recovery. A new vision for New York includes greater popular participation in city budgeting efforts, affordable housing development, a moratorium on evictions, a living wage for all, green job creation. New York needs to be a sanctuary city for undocumented workers. The passage of the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights and the Farm Worker Protection Act are two very clear measures that can make a real material difference in the lives of hundreds of thousands of our most marginalized workforces and most important workforces. There are bills in the legislature now that can go if we come together in the way that we need to. We need to expand the access to unemployment, similar to how 9/11 relief funds were available to all who were impacted, including undocumented workers. Why can't we make unemployment available to all workers, even undocumented workers, regardless of what sector you're in? We need the political will to do that. New York needs a new Green Deal that's defined by new organizing, new alliances, new collaborations between labor, community, and independent worker organizing around a comprehensive platform for economic recovery, democracy, and sustainability. The New York economy has been structured around meeting the needs of the professional class in the financial sector. It needs to be shifted to focus on meeting the basic needs of all workers. And if we act in solidarity and unity, we can start to make that happen. Starting in February, Domestic Workers United, Jobs with Justice, and the Immigrant Justice Solidarity Project are going to be doing monthly workers' rights canvassing, bringing together dozens of domestic workers, union members, students, and activists to collect letters of support for the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights and the Employee Free Choice Act as two examples of proactive policy initiatives to promote economic sustainability, democracy, and economic stimulus. We need to come together and fight together around all of these things in the interest of the working class. Many of us have seen the destruction of historic working class communities through the process of gentrification over the last decade. One of the things that we would love to be a part of is looking at some of the luxury condominium developments that have been sprouting up all over the city. Many of them are not going to be able to be built. They're halfway built and there's no capital to continue. Or they're going to be built and they're not going to be able, the units are not going to be sold because of the financial crisis. How do we reclaim that land, that housing, and that space for working class communities? I'm talking about a collaboration between laborers' unions to finish that work that needs to be done and community organizations that have been fighting gentrification and fighting for affordable housing, working together to turn those luxury developments into affordable housing cooperatives for union members and community residents who have been facing displacement from gentrification. There is no reason why we can't do that. Our vision has to be about deep economic transformation. We can start tomorrow in terms of building and modeling what that looks like. We need to be about new collaborations, broad, comprehensive demands for recovery and sustainability and democracy, a new Green Deal for all. And we have to make sure that the groups of workers that have been historically excluded, marginalized, made invisible are not only at the table, but are at the center of this work. We don't want another New Deal that excludes domestic workers and farm workers, that makes it impossible for working class African Americans or immigrants to come together and build political power. That is not the kind of New Deal we want now. The kind of New Deal we want now puts those workforces at the center of our movement and our demands and moves broad spectrums of society towards demands in the interests of the entire working class. In these times of crisis, the first thing that happens is groups of workers get pitted against each other. And so if we remember that principle and that philosophy and that vision for a New York City, new Green Deal for all, we can build the strongest working class movement this history has ever seen.
And we're going to continue on those themes of the economy and the world of work with two people who are specifically suited to look at that with us.
We're joined by Arun Gupta, editor of The Independent, and William Tabb, president emeritus of economics, Queens College.
Maybe we can start with just that bottom line. So Mr. Obama has kind of upped from 3 million to 4 million jobs, the prognosis as to what will be accomplished, the creation of such with the stimulus package. Perhaps you can both just start by addressing whether there really are that number of jobs that can be created, shovel-ready jobs, and we're ready to put America back to work.
Why don't you go for it, Bill?
There will be jobs created, but there won't be enough jobs created. A year from now, the unemployment rate will probably be around 10%. This is very serious, very deep. The shovel-ready part assumes that all your unemployed computer programmers and Wall Street stock analysts are going to get out there with pick and shovels, which seems to me, while a very good idea in a sort of Maoist way, rather unlikely. So I think that sort of talk is not to be taken altogether seriously.
Obama has been saying save or create jobs. That should cause alarm when you say save a job. There's no credible way to measure whether or not a job has been saved. They're already kind of engaging in this accounting fiction that they want to use to then down the line say, well, we have like saved or created this many jobs.
Arun, remember, he's going to pay employers for every job they save. So I would expect they will, quote, save, unquote, huge amounts of jobs for which the taxpayers will pay.
That's one of the most absurd proposals there is. He's going to give $3,000. That's not going to make a difference to any single employer. Now, an employer who's going to expand by hiring people, there's still companies that do expand in a downturn, will gladly take that $3,000. But that $3,000 will make no difference to some business owners. Not going to be like, gee, I can make $3,000 if I hire another person. That's just a pure giveaway. There's some good analysis that that's been put out by Moody's, their chief economist, Mark Zandi. He tallies up what the potential multiplier is effect of various stimulus. At the top are things that conservatives hate, things like food stamps and unemployment insurance. Conservatives are loath to admit this, but the best way to stimulate the economy is by putting money into the hands of poor people, because they are the ones who are likeliest to go out and spend it on foods, on clothing, the necessities of life.
Oh, also, ruin you tax and spend person. How terrible. See, if we Republicans are going to go along with this, you've got to give tax cuts to rich people. It won't help the economy any, but we're not going to vote for it otherwise, because we believe tax cuts are the way to go. And when you have a fellow like Mr. Obama, who wants to be very bipartisan about it, even before the negotiations begin, he already is putting $300 billion of this money, in your view, probably quite wastefully, into giving tax cuts, which, as Andy and others point out, have very low multiplier effects, won't help at all, will not create shovel-ready or any other kind of job.
We need to critique everything that's going on, not just to be reactive and oppositional for the sake of it, but to really look, is this going to work or not? There's some environmentalists, they're claiming that up to 75% of the roads that are proposed to be built under the shovel-ready category are to these exurbs and suburbs that are in crisis. A big part of the housing fallout, the burst of the housing bubble, is that a lot of these exurb communities that were thrown up in the last 10 years are becoming ghost towns. So a lot of states had planned to build highways out to them, and they're putting these forward as the shovel-ready jobs. The idea in building these roads is, well, you're going to build these thoroughfares to these communities, and with the hope that by building this transportation corridors, then businesses will come and, you know, you'll have retail, you'll have fast food, gas stations, etc. But if you're building them to ghost communities, it's not going to have any real multiplier effect.
Right. But in addition to that, all of this focus on construction employs males, for one thing, and males who do construction work. Mm-hmm. And it's to say that things like child care and helping elderly people who need home visits and stuff like that, the kind of things that we're not putting money into, especially as our population ages, that can be done by both men and women, are not as important.
Well, you literally want to create the nanny state, which the Republicans are always...
No, tonight I'm being the Republican, you're being the Democrat.
We can switch masks. Yes, that's a very good point. Like, some of the more positive aspects of the stimulus proposals are things like for the federal government to cover state budget deficits. Of course, that's a whole other issue, that why do most states have these laws against being able to run yearly deficits? It's this absurd rhetoric, well, government should be run like a family. It's not even like government should be run by business. Every single business...
Well, no, I'm not sure I'm in agreement there, that what a lot of governors do, even in good times, is they borrow money, which is what New York State did. When they did have a lot of money, they spent it all and borrowed more, creating a kind of situation that when we did have the kind of problems we're having now, their ability to borrow is much more limited. So that the way this is done, I agree with you, of course, that you shouldn't have to balance the budget year by year, but the penchant for politicians to not want to raise taxes and the whole ideology that you can spend money you don't have and you don't have to ask people to pay for the services that they want and deserve, and you shouldn't do it in a progressive way because you'll scare the rich. All of that is part of the state and local thing. At the same time, what we're seeing in states and local governments across the country is laying off people, closing down fire stations and hospitals, emergency rooms that people desperately need. And I think we would both agree that getting money to those very important public services that especially working people depend on is crucial, as well as, of course, the jobs of the state and local workers who would then be unemployed, adding more drag to the economy.
That's completely right. You know, I was just suggesting that it would be good if states did have that tool. Of course, then you are dealing with this history where a lot of local governments do that in terms of borrowing money rather than having progressive taxation. Like, our own governor resisted for months, Patterson, against even wanting to entertain the idea that we would raise taxes on the rich, saying that they would flee the state. That's the most absurd thing I've ever heard. We could easily put some sort of wealth tax, or we could, the way there used to be a tax on the sale of stocks.
What I would prefer to see in terms of emphasis is what Richard Nixon initiated and was one of the more progressive things any president, Republican or Democrat, has done in this area, to raise taxes at the federal level. And we would, of course, want to do that, as you say, progressively, and then distribute it to state and local governments through revenue sharing, so that governments that are not as rich as others get more assistance and can meet the needs of their people. By collecting taxes nationally and distributing to rich and poor in relation to need, you overcome some of these problems of rich suburbs versus poor suburbs and their ability to help people. I would also say one of the things that we would want to see in the coming years is global taxation of transnational corporations and a closing down of tax havens where the rich are able to avoid taxes, whether it's to New York, New Jersey, or Connecticut. The Grand Cayman Islands is the fifth largest economy in the world in terms of banking, and that's purely a tax avoidance on the part of the corporate wealthy, so that we would want to push Obama into dealing with the extent to which the corporate wealthy rip us off continuously. I would add that the inheritance tax thing they're proposing is good. That is not to get rid of the inheritance tax. Inheritance tax is one of the most important taxes we have to prevent creating a perpetuating aristocracy.
I want to bring up the issue of what Obama said last week about entitlements. On the one hand, I was flabbergasted that he would say that, quote, we need to address the issue of entitlements. But on the other hand, I really wasn't surprised because he's very much a Wall Street Democrat in the mold of neoliberalism. He's picked an economic team that are pretty much from top to bottom proponents of neoliberalism. And what was really incredible about this statement, he's essentially arguing that we need to cut Social Security and Medicare, which are the foundation of the workers and the middle class in this country in terms of having at least something to hold on to in retirement. The idea of cutting Social Security is completely absurd because it's completely funded off books through the payroll tax. What the implications are is that there's about $2.4 trillion in U.S. government bonds that have been deposited into the Social Security Trust Fund because the government keeps raiding it to mask the true nature of the federal budget deficit. The Social Security Trust is running a surplus year after year. So the idea is that they would then somehow default on those bonds. Well, why don't we default on the bonds that the rich own, that we've used to prop up Citigroup, that's owned by central banks around the world? Instead, they want to stick it to workers. Just phenomenally regressive.
Yeah, I think we want to underline that point because I think many of us were quite happy when Obama won over McCain. McCain was a Neanderthal, and the policies he would have followed would have been dreadful. On the other hand, what we're seeing Obama do is a Bill Clinton triangulation.
That is, that's right.
He is opposing the progressives in his own party, cozying up to the Republicans and the conservatives, and not reversing what Paulson has done in these tremendous giveaways. That the focus has been on the $700 billion that Paulson asked Congress to give. But that is a small part, and I know saying $700 billion is a small part, Mason, but it truly is. It's a small part of the trillions of dollars that the taxpayer is now on the hook for, either because of guarantees or because of buying assets at ridiculous prices from the banks and the other financial corporations. The bailout, like to AIG, now up to something like $150 billion, is terrible, but it's a small part of what they've done when they've encouraged these mergers and the Federal Reserve and the FDIC and the other government agencies and the Treasury say, we will take 90% of the losses above $20 billion or something of this portfolio, putting us at incredible risk because I expect this to go on for 3-5 more years with high unemployment through this period, and there will be defaults on this stuff, and the taxpayer then will find that these policies that were just slipped through without any discussion and without any transparency, the public has no idea of the commitments they have made With our money.
That's right. The Federal Reserve. Now, what they're doing is they've created all these facilities that they're essentially backstopping credit. They've become the lender of not last resort. They become the lender of only resort. They're propping up various credit markets, money markets, and they haven't poured all this money, which ultimately is our money, but they are guaranteeing it, and it is something in the range of, I think, like $8 trillion. I saw some figure that's something like $3.4 trillion. That's been pumped out by the Federal Reserve directly and the Treasury. So it is absolutely enormous sums of money. There's one last point that I'd like to hit, just because the speech we were just hearing was discussing this Green New Deal idea, and it's very important to start to challenge this fundamentally from a socialist perspective. Of course, we need to transition the economy away from hydrocarbons, but the Green New Deal is basically, the way it's going to be constructed is to create a new speculative bubble. It becomes a new fix for capital. The purpose of it will be to resolve the economic crisis that capital is undergoing now, not the ecological crisis that the planet is suffering from. That's because one of the key points of this Green New Deal will be carbon trading, that is, permits in the trading of pollution rights. These are very ineffective, and they're fraught with all sorts of possibilities of fraudulent accounting and making up and cooking books in terms of what emissions are. It creates this absolutely enormous market in the trading of pollution rights. And all the Wall Street banks, every investment bank in the world as of a year ago had set up a carbon trading desk, because their estimate is by 2020 carbon trading will be a bigger market than all energy markets combined. And that's absolutely staggeringly enormous. What their hope is that they'll make all this money off the carbon trading and then off all the derivatives. But it won't actually address the underlying ecological crisis. The real way to do that is through a carbon tax, where you're directly pricing in the externality into oil, such as, you know, let's put a tax on the barrel of oil that constantly keeps it at least $100 a barrel. And that way you would start to push the economy much more quickly away from hydrocarbon usage, but they don't want to do that.
What people have to understand is they want this to be over and they want Obama to succeed. And I would love for Obama to succeed and for it to be over. But as we said earlier, the ammunition they're using doesn't begin to be enough, and it's not directed enough at the people who need the help. And unless there is a very strong movement pushing him from the left and pushing him really hard and not waiting around hoping he'll do something better than it looks like he's going to do, we're going to have a very rough next 3-5 years.
William Tabb, Professor Emeritus of Economics, Queens College, and Arun Gupta, editor of The Independent. Thanks for that exchange. It was absolutely insightful.
And this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.